Okay. I am Shannon Zeltman. It is November 9th, 2018, and I'm in one of the classrooms in YNCell Hall at Gaysburg College with Wayne Van Nostrand to talk about his experience during the Vietnam War era. So, to start off, let's start with the beginning of your life. Where did you grow up?
I was born in 1945 in Bloomfield, New Jersey. That's Essex County, New Jersey, about 15 minutes west of Manhattan.
Okay. What was your childhood like?
At the risk of sounding over the top, I would call it idyllic. I grew up in a traditional family. Back then, we were middle class. Back then, the fathers worked and the mothers didn't. We lived in a compact neighborhood. There was extended family there all the time. It was a very loving environment. My dad was I would call him a typical provider. He was stern, firm, but also loving and caring. Worked overtime when our family needed it. My mom essentially raised me. But there, like I said, there was always people around, whether they were friends or family. Dinner time, half the time it seemed there were people outside of our family there. I was the first kid born and was the first kid for a while. My first sister came 7 years later, my second sister 10 years later. And it was a joyful time, and I can expand as however you'd like to.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were your parents' names and siblings as well?
My dad's name was Walter, my mom's name was Kay, and my sister's name were Lynn and Gail.
Okay. And then what did your dad do?
He worked, and this was, I guess, lucky for me. I was born right at the end of World War II.
Right.
And my dad did not serve because he worked for Westinghouse building aircraft engines. Thus, he was not called to serve. Mm-hmm. And had he not been there, I probably wouldn't have been born. So it was a good deal.
Yeah. So, guess, what was your neighborhood like growing up and all?
It was a really safe place and a really social place. I would say I knew the names of, and could say hello and visit in the houses of at least 50 different families, which is rare these days.
Yes.
And we played in the streets and on the playgrounds. There was no fear of any problem being kids, even little kids, because the moms were always there. And mm-hmm. if anybody had a problem, anybody fell down and lost a tooth or anything like that, another mom would pick them up, bring them home, and take care of it. Playing was essentially got home, did my homework, and then played until dark, depending on the season. Mm-hmm. And it was the old school democratic playing. You know, people pick sides, and if you weren't picked, you didn't play.
What were some of the games that you played?
We played baseball, football, basketball. Those were the main sports then, still are, and that's primarily the. In high school, I played soccer and tennis, but growing up, I played mostly those three games.
Okay. Did you play soccer and tennis for a team at your high school?
Yeah, at the pro high school team.
Okay. Did you go to church?
Yes. Went to a Presbyterian church. Mm-hmm. Okay. And did some things through the church. I played in a church basketball league, which was really pretty interesting because it expanded my horizons. We played some other churches in my general vicinity, but we also played churches in Harlem and in Spanish Harlem, which was a world I had not seen before. And it was a great learning experience. Mm-hmm. And those kids killed us in basketball.
Did you think church was really influential on your life?
No.
Okay.
I got a great sense of value from my family. Church is not a negative, mm-hmm. but it was not a formative experience.
Right. And then besides tennis and soccer, what were some of the other things you did in high school?
I was a good student, and I liked the academic part of high school. I liked academics all the way through. Mm-hmm. But I was also involved in a lot of activities. I was president of some clubs. I was National Honor Society. I was New Jersey Boy State. Do you know what that is?
No.
It's a honor. You know, they choose a few kids in each school to do that.
Okay.
And then there was the social side. I loved, eventually when we got to driving, cruising with my friends. I loved going to dances. I loved going to football games. Again, it stayed idyllic. It was really a positive, fun experience.
Mm-hmm. And then also, I know the Vietnam War started in 1955. So, like, while you were growing up, how old were you in 1955?
10.
Okay. So, like, did you know that that was starting? And, like, did you follow national politics? I mean, not 10 necessarily, but just, like, going through your high school experience and everything.
Media was certainly different then.
Right. You know,
up until I was 10, or maybe up until I was 8, we didn't have a TV.
Okay, yeah.
and there were big events like that. You know, you got your first TV and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I was not aware of Vietnam. The only thing I was really aware of was the Cold War, mm-hmm. You know, and the U.S.-Russia relationships post-World War II. And in school, we had the atom bomb drills, where you would go onto your desk. We had them probably more often than we had fire drills.
Really?
So the paranoia was associated with nuclear attack rather than Vietnam. I wasn't aware of Vietnam, I wouldn't say, until maybe senior year in high school or first year of college.
Mm. Okay. And then how did you hear about Gettysburg and decide to come here?
We had done research. We had done good research. And I narrowed it down to 4 schools: Gettysburg, Franklin and Marshall, Williams and Amherst. And we visited all of them. And this is not quantifiable, but there was a vibe here. I loved campus. I still do. Whenever I come here, I won't today, but on a nice day, I'll walk all over the campus. And the students were extremely welcoming. Back then, I remember stopping at, we did the same weekend. We went to Franklin and Marshall one day and Gettysburg another day. And Franklin and Marshall then was all men. Mm-hmm. And that was off-putting to me. It didn't seem like a real world. I probably still wouldn't. But as we walked through here, students were kind and openly said hi. And we passed a couple professors who were, you know, just we do ask for directions, and they would be very helpful. And so it was less an academic choice and more a social or aesthetic choice. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I made it.
That's good. Did you have an idea of what you're going to do when, like, in high school when you were coming to Gettysburg?
Yeah, I wanted to be an English professor.
Okay. And what made you decide you wanted to be an English professor?
I think, like a lot of people, I was good at it. I read voraciously, mm-hmm. and I loved books, and I loved, not all my teachers, you know, some teachers in high school were average, but some were fabulous. So I loved the combination of reading and literature and teaching.
Mm-hmm. Did you have, like, a favorite teacher who, like, pushed you in that direction, or was it just your love of reading that?
Oddly enough, the teacher who pushed me in that direction in high school was not an English teacher. It was a lady named Catherine McBrayer, who was just out of college. She was probably 22 at the time. But she took an interest in me and talked to me and asked me what I wanted to do, and she was the one who pushed me in that direction.
Okay. How did she push you in some of those ways?
There was times after class, times her period, be like lunch would come after her period.
Mm-hmm.
And she would take 5 minutes and talk to me, and she would flatter me and say that, ask me what I liked, and told me that she thought that would be a good direction for me. When you're 17, flattery works. Well, I think it probably works at any age, but
yeah,
it really worked then.
Did you have like a favorite book?
Yeah, my favorite book, it still is, and I read it probably every year, is The Great Gatsby.
Okay.
Have you read it?
Not yet. Okay. I want to read it, but...
Yeah, it is, to me, it's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But I still read some old, but more current.
Right. So, I guess, yeah, you kind of explained what your major is, would be English.
Yeah.
So, what were some of the other things you did on campus?
Well, it was, I'll start by giving a bigger picture, if that's okay.
That's fine.
It was really, really special to come here. Again, I talked about it, the place felt so good. I lived in Rice Hall. I met a bunch of new friends. I loved going to the football games. We had, if this is possible for you to even fathom, we had mandatory chapel. Every Thursday we had to go to chapel.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we had, back then, first semester fraternity rush. It was instant, like within a week or two of you getting there. And I got rushed, and I joined Phi Gamma Delta right across here. And that became a big part of my life. It was like instant friends, and I liked the brothers that were already there. I liked the guys in my pledge class. Greek life was ruled at that point. I know it's less now. And that became a big part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked a lot of the functions. We had the things like faculty teas, which were nice, and tons of professors would come, and it would give you a chance to see them out of their normal milieu,
right,
chat with them and talk to some professors you didn't have, and it was really a pleasant experience.
Mm-hmm.
We had a house mother, who, do you know that concept?
I've heard of them.
Yeah, she lived in our house with us, and that was nice. We dressed for Sunday dinner, mm-hmm, coat and tie for Sunday dinner. I mean, a long time ago. And, as a pledge, we did not have hazing as you would know it, but there was things you had to do, like we waited tables at dinner and cleaned the house. The worst job was being the wake-up guy. You had to get up early and spend your morning, except for when you went to class, waking brothers. They all slept in a dorm on the top floor.
Mm-hmm.
So they would all put this little tag, and it would say they want to get up at 7:30 to get to their 7:50 class. And then they would, I'm not getting up, and you had to go back again. And that was the worst job.
So you're like a human alarm clock?
That's right. Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh.
But I loved the special weekends. I loved house parties. Christmas house party was very unique for us. The fraternity had a tradition that went way back of two things. One is we had a relationship with a farmer who let us cut down greenery. And we would take it back to the fraternity house, decorate the outside, but also decorate the entire first floor with greenery on the walls. All of the walls were covered in greenery. However, the fire marshal required that the heat be off when we did that. So for about a week, we lived with no heat. Guys would bring their dates out for Christmas house parties, and nobody really had an idea what anybody's date looked like because they were covered up and they had a hat, and only you could see their eyes. We also had a long history of hayride out in the apple orchards. Originally, it was done by horses, but that was a long time ago. We now had John Deere tractors would take us.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd be a keg on the different, the flatbeds on behind them, and people would bring guitars and sing and drink beer, and it was a really nice experience. I like traditions like that. I like ritual, and I like tradition.
Right. So what was it like having a house mother and everything? And who was the house mother?
Her name was Gertrude Eckstein.
Okay.
Going back, I would say that she was probably mid-60s mm-hmm. when I got here. It was nice, and I know it lent a sense of decorum. Teenage voices you may have experienced can get out of control. but there was an unwritten rule that when she was around, you were cool. You treated her with respect, you treated others with respect. And I really think she served a great purpose. I also like playing cards. I played bridge, and she played bridge. So a lot of times, three of the brothers and Mrs. Eckstein would play bridge together, which was always nice. She ate with us. She ate at the head table. Somebody else pulled out a chair. It was a decorous experience. I liked it.
Okay. And then also, I know some in, like, the 60s, they had the first-year traditions with, like, wearing the cappies and things like that. Did you have experience any of that?
It was right at the end of that, but the freshmen then were supposed to. Mm-hmm. I don't recall wearing mine, and I don't recall ever getting called out. Because I don't think people could tell as you're walking across campus who was a freshman or not.
Right.
So I don't recall wearing mine, although there were plenty of people wearing them.
How long were people wearing them for?
I don't recall.
Okay.
I mean, it was at least weeks.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then also, like, what was it like just rushing so quickly into a fraternity?
It was truly rushing. It was a whirlwind.
Mm-hmm.
You got an idea from talking to the guys in your dorm who you should go see and who you shouldn't go see, because some guys would go to one, some guys would go to another, and we come back and compare notes.
Right.
And you quickly narrow it down, and once you narrow it down, you would go back to them and talk to different brothers. And I particularly like talking to guys who had been there for a while, because they've experienced the whole arc of the fraternity life. And I would also seek out guys that looked to me and were probably going to pledge there too, or talk to them. But it was truly a whirlwind. And they treat you really well. I mean, they feed you well and put their arms around you, and it's a really welcoming experience. And then shortly thereafter, you're waking them up and waiting their tables.
Did you do anything else on campus besides the fraternity?
Well, most of the stuff was through fraternity. I played intramural sports through the fraternity.
Okay.
I played tennis. I played soccer through the fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
But other than studies and intramural sports and all the fraternity stuff, that's essentially my life here.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the classes that you took?
Mostly English classes, obviously.
Right.
When I started, there was a mandatory religion class.
Mm-hmm.
There was phys ed and health back then. Does that still exist?
No.
Yeah. People get their own exercise. Now you go to gym.
Yes.
But that's essentially the track.
Okay.
I remember a couple of the English professors uniquely, the head of the department was a man named Dr. Geyer, who was, in a good way, right out of Central Casting. He had the tweed jacket, he had the pipe, and he really looked the part of the English professor. Like, I'd seen movies, that's him. And he carried himself that way.
Mm-hmm.
And commanded respect that way. There was also a professor named Emil Schmidt, who in 1963, 64, before anybody had long hair, he did. But he was an English professor, so he could be you know, kind of a bohemian type guy at that point, which I think attracted some people to him.
Mm-hmm. Did you have, like, a favorite professor on campus?
I think Dr. Geyer was my favorite, and some of that was what he taught and how he taught, and some of it was just what he represented.
I'll
answer anything.
Okay. let's see. When you were on campus, like, I guess, were there any peace protests beginning when you started your Gettysburg experience?
No, they all came. I don't recall any when I was originally here.
Mm-hmm.
When I came back, it was Katie barred the door.
Okay.
It was all over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, were you in ROTC at all? Okay. What were your friends like on campus?
Most of my friends were in the fraternity. Some weren't.
Mm-hmm.
But they were mostly guys who were somewhat athletic, liked to have fun. Most came from similar backgrounds, middle class. I mean, I could say white middle class, but that's all anybody here was back at that time. There was no diversity at that point.
Right.
They were mostly guys from New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, with similar backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things about being here at the time, and it's something I still like now in living situations, is that everything's in one place. That the classes are accessible. The football game, you don't have to drive to. Plays, concerts. I'll say this in all honesty, you understand. And even girls are right there. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah, so it was really, it's a change from your life when you were in high school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you work on campus?
No. I worked in the summers, but I did not work on campus.
Okay. What did you do over the summer?
I'll tell you two different things. I started when I was a kid doing newspapers, delivering papers. And then in the summer, I would work in a gas station or work in a nursery. But my family would also take a vacation to the Jersey Shore in the summer. And during that time, I didn't work. And that's another ritual that I enjoy. My father would take our car, get ready for our 75-minute trip down the shore and rotate the tires and get it tuned up. It was different. And we would always go to the same house. Always have do similar things. Like there's a day we'd go crabbing and a day we'd go to the amusement park and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a great life at the shore also. And my whole family would come.
Including like aunts and uncles?
Aunts and uncles and grandmothers. I never knew either grandfather. Both my grandfathers died in their 30s, both in accidents. So more females.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom is the most positive, optimistic person I have ever met. And except for perhaps her mom. And my mom's still alive. I just celebrated her 98th birthday 2 weeks ago.
Oh.
And her mom died when she was, I believe, 94. So there's something to be said about those good genes, but also I think about the attitude they took toward life. They found good, and my mom continues to find good in everything.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
How did you feel about your dad growing up?
Well, like I said, my mom was there more than my dad.
Right.
I respected my dad. My dad played in a work softball league.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to be maybe 15 or 16, if one of the guys couldn't play, he asked me to come play with all the grown-up men. And it was like, oh, my heart. You know, this is like the greatest thing that's ever been asked of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have his bat. I have his bat propped against the fireplace in my house now. It was so good. So my dad's relationship with me was a respectful one. It was love, but it was respectful. Whereas with my mom, it was full-on embraceable love.
Right.
So I will tell this. This is an aside, but
that's fine.
My oldest sister Lynn came home from high school. She might have been 14 or 15 at the time, and asked my mom to sit down to talk with her. And they did it. And Lynn said, "I have a complaint. Our life is too boring. The girls at school talk about their parents fighting, and this has happened, this has happened." My mom said, "My mom said that's not going to change, dear." There was no divorce then. Mm-hmm. Nobody divorced then. And even from a young age, you could see couples that didn't want to be with each other, but nobody divorced.
Right. That must have been, yeah. What was your relationship like with your sisters?
It was loving, and I was glad to be their big brother, and they loved when my friends came over. Mm-hmm. But there was this huge gap. When I left for college, my sisters were 11 and 8. You know, so there's a huge age gap. So it wasn't that we were into any of the same things.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a loving relationship, and still is. We still see each other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I still see high school friends all the time and college friends all the time, too. In the last 2.5 months, I've seen 10 guys I went to college with. So it's been a great continuum.
Mm-hmm. So then how did you, for the war, how did you end up serving in the Army? Were you drafted or?
Here comes the story that's going to change your opinion of me completely. You're going to think now that I'm the stupidest guy in America. I had completed 7 semesters at Gettysburg.
Mm-hmm.
And left. I was home on Christmas break in between semesters. And a friend of mine who had left college a couple years before came to our house and he said, "I'm going to Miami. I know some people there we can live with. You want to go?" And I checked in with the school, checked in with my parents who weren't happy at all. My father said, "I'll respect your decision, but I'm done with supporting you. You know, when you come back to school, you have to pay for it yourself." And I said, "I understand that." And I went. I lived in Miami. And I'll digress here so I can answer your question. It's probably on your mind. It took me years and years and years and years and years to figure out why I did that. And I think, now I'm sure, the reason I did it is that I was terrified that this idyllic life was going to end. So I made sure that it didn't. So I'm now in the stupidest guy. No. But it all worked out. So I went to Miami, and we were getting by, strangely enough, gambling, playing cards, betting on horses.
Okay. Were you, like, living in an apartment or something?
We were living with some other people.
Okay.
Who nicely took us in for free. You know, we helped them cook and pay for groceries and stuff like that. And the draft notice came to my home in New Jersey, and my parents forwarded it to me, and I got drafted.
So, I guess, where did you have, like, basic training and all of that? Or?
Yeah, I'll tell you that. I'll start with some advice I got, some from family, some with friends. I went down to the induction center in Newark, New Jersey. I went in on my birthday. And a friend had told me, in the induction center, get down in your chair as low as you can. And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because quite often, Marine recruiters will come in, and they will often pick a few guys, and they usually will pick the biggest guys they see. And that happened when I was there. And a Marine sergeant came in, and he just pointed at five guys and said, come with me. And they were drafted into the Marines. I went from the Newark Induction Center to Fort Knox in Louisville, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And I had gotten two pieces of advice before I started basic. One was very mundane and one was very important. The mundane one was, take a top bunk because it's much easier to make the bed. Which is important in basic training, because if your bed has one little crease out of line, you're going to do extra push-ups or extra kitchen police or any of that stuff.
Right.
So that was a good tip. The other tip was, be invisible. Make no noise at all. You don't want the sergeant, the drill instructors, to know your name. And that was a great tip, because some guys mount back, mount thigh, to the point where they were always called out. They were always doing extra push-ups, extra everything, being made to skip meals, running far. And some got so much to the case where they had a repeat basic training, which you never want to do.
Oh, wow.
Basic training was a real slap in my face. You know, I think typically as a kid in America, or in any, probably in any country, you think you've got life pretty well figured out, and you have opinions, and that's natural, right? You have that.
Right.
And in the Army, and it's necessary, particularly if you're an enlistment, you can't have opinions. You can't go into a battle situation and have the person in charge say, here's what we're going to do. You can't raise your hand and say, I think we should do this. There's no time for that. So what they do is they really deprogram any individual thinking and make you learn to follow the rules. They also get you into incredible physical shape. I remember, I remember the first day getting my hair cut off, and I had to pay for it. That doesn't seem right.
No, it doesn't.
And then we were at Fort Knox, and it was September and October. And here we are for those 2 months in Kentucky, and we would fall out in the morning. I guess it was 6 a.m. We would fall out and get in our formation and make sure everybody was there. And they would have us have a vote. Here's democracy working. And we could decide we would wear our uniform. We would have a T-shirt and a regular Army shirt and an Army jacket. And at that point, we had to decide which we were going to wear all day. We didn't have weather reports. So there were days it would be cold in the morning and warm up, and we're just sweating our butts off because we have our jackets on. And at other days, because the previous day we got cold, we'd go in T-shirts and freeze. But again, it's kind of, you know, getting the group mentality going.
Mm-hmm.
I got to know some guys in basic training and to respect some guys, but you don't really build relationships because you're constantly working.
Right.
You're learning how to do things. You're either doing physical exercise, learning how to shoot, learning how to run, learning how to assemble logs to climb over and things like that. It was 8 weeks. I was about 200 pounds when I went in, and after 8 weeks I weighed 155.
Oh, wow. When did you start basic training?
Just about September 1st of 1967.
Okay.
From basic training, you go to advanced training. And it's fairly typical for them to not know exactly what they're going to do with you right away.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't eligible to go to infantry training because I'm not correctable to 2020. So they had to figure out something for me to do. So there was a period of maybe 2 weeks where I was still at Fort Knox, but I wasn't assigned to any company or anything, just waiting for my next orders.
Right.
So for the first week and a half, I was given a rake. And from 8 in the morning until 6 at night, there was a quad, like there would be a quad in a college. And my job was to make sure that there was never a leaf on the ground in that quad.
Oh,
that's
God.
What I did. it's as mundane as you can be.
Right.
The next job I got was dramatically different. And I only had it for, I think, 3 days before my orders came. And that was, I was one of two people running a road gang. This is soldiers who are in the brig, in the prison, the army base, for having done things wrong. And they're out picking up trash off the highway. And I have a shotgun. I learned how to shoot a shotgun, but I don't want to shoot anybody. And they tell you, if somebody starts running, fire a shot over their head. If they keep running, fire a shot at their feet. And they said, particularly if they're running at you, do the same thing. Luckily, I don't think I could have done it.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, none of that ever happened.
That's good.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
So I got assigned to Fort Rucker, Alabama,
mm-hmm.
which was an aviation base. And what I learned there was to be an aviation operations specialist. I really embraced this. And the job I ended up having in Vietnam was that I would, with other people, organize the aircraft needed for operations, mm-hmm. whether they were assaults or resupply or even stuff like Bob Hope. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean by that? You know, Bob Hope would come with, would be like a USO ship to entertain the troops.
Right.
So we were in charge of doing that. And I loved what they taught me at Fort Rucker. I graduated number one in my class, and I was really proud of that. I think there was 70 people in my class. And it all made sense to me, you know, certain things do, certain things don't. And the stuff they taught me about that made tons of sense. The only thing I didn't like about Fort Rucker is on weekends we had to put, this was November into January, we had to put Christmas decorations on the officers' houses who lived off base, and putting up Christmas decorations in Alabama in 70 and 80 degrees didn't feel right to me, but you did reach out to.
Mm-hmm. So how did you end up going to the air base in
Fuloy?
Fuloy, okay. But.
Well, at the end of my aviation training in Alabama, sergeant comes out and he's got a list of all the people who have been in my 70-person class. And he, I think it was five or six, he reads five or six names. And he says, you six are going to this base in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
He pauses and he goes, the other 64 of you are going to be at home. And you always held out hope that you weren't.
Right.
And my heart sank, but there I am. Then you get leave before you go.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard with, you know, saying goodbye to your friends, hard saying goodbye to your parents, because you don't know if you're going to see them again. It's
right.
Terribly hard. And I went. Go ahead.
How did your parents react to when you were drafted and then going to Vietnam?
I don't remember a reaction to me being drafted. Mm-hmm. But their reaction to me going to Vietnam was, I think what any loving parent would be, to please stay in touch. Please be safe. Do whatever you can to be safe. And that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the communication is negligible. You write me. My mom said, write me letters. I don't care if you write me what you had for dinner that night, mm-hmm. but write me letters.
Right.
And I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I also asked them and friends to do the same for me. And they did too. So, and that contact, you know, nobody had a cell phone. And
no.
There was no ability to call at all.
Right.
So, old fashioned snail mail. And it was very snail going from U.S. to Vietnam.
I bet.
was how it happened. Mm-hmm. And, but when you got those letters, it was like Christmas.
Right. How often did you get letters?
I would say three, sometimes 4 a week. I had a great coterie of people who were taking care of me through the marriage.
That's good.
It was good. I also had my mom and a friend. This may not compute, but, and I'll get into ways of life, sent me spices so that we could take the bland food and make it taste better. And it was wonderful. Mm-hmm. So I left from Fort Dix, New Jersey, and went to San Francisco. From San Francisco, we then took a commercial plane to Tokyo. We went from San Francisco to Alaska, and then Alaska to Tokyo, and Tokyo to Vietnam.
It's been quite a flight going all the way around. So what was it like when you first got there?
It was a shock, I'd seen some of the stuff on TV, but it's just this landscape. It's either nothing or jungle, except for Saigon, which was a city. I got there a few times, but other than that, we flew into Saigon and then flew into Phu Loi. And I don't want to make this sound as good as college, but the people were terribly welcoming. Wonderful, wonderful officers and enlisted guys, really welcome. Glad to see me. And I think, and I was welcoming when people came after that, and nobody tells you to do it. I think it's because you all realize you're in this boat together. So you better be friends. And you're going to need each other's help. Mm-hmm. So I had a very interesting experience before I got my job, because it's not pure, the timing of when the guy before you is leaving and you're coming. So I got there and I had about a week before my job would start. So for that week, I got to be on night patrol on the perimeter of the air base. So I'm on this, like it's sandbagged, and I don't remember if I was on a chair on my knees. There must have been a chair behind me and I'd sometime be on my knees. And I'm sitting behind a machine gun. And you're wired up on a headset, and there's a lieutenant, I believe it was a lieutenant, who was in charge of the whole thing. And it was guys like me all around the whole base. Mm-hmm. And people report in. This is the best story of that. I never ended up shooting at anybody. There was no land attack at the time. We would get attacked by mortars all the time, rockets. Mm-hmm. But there was no ground attack. However, we're on there one night, might have been the second or third night I'm there, and one of the guys comes on, and he says, "I see something moving, and it's big." And the lieutenant says, "What is it?" The guy goes, "I can't tell you." And the lieutenant says, "Keep watching." The guy comes back on, and he goes, "It's a cow." And the lieutenant says, "One cow or more than one?" And the guy goes, "I only see one right now." And the lieutenant goes, if it turns into more than one, or it starts moving forward, kill it. And I found out later that the Viet Cong and the Northern Vietnamese Army would use cows to come across minefields.
Oh, to set off the mines.
To set off the mines, and then they would follow them in.
Oh.
So, this was our bovine attack experience. Luckily, the cow didn't come, so he didn't shoot it.
That's good. Lucky for the cow.
Yeah, that's right. Who wants to shoot anything?
Yeah, right.
So, I eventually got assigned. I had a big advantage. everything's relative. I wasn't sleeping in the jungle. I was at an airbase, and my home was what's called a hooch, and it's a concrete slab with like canvas dividers dividing up rooms, mm-hmm. And at some stages there would be metal poles, and then a corrugated metal roof on top, and screens and a door in the front. There'd be two of us in each hooch, and there'd be maybe, I don't know, 10 hooches all along there. Kind of like a dorm.
Yeah.
But not as nice. So inside, there would be my hooch mate and I would each have a cot.
Mm-hmm.
And we had shelves made out of cinder blocks and wood and stored stuff either under our bed or on those shelves.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing they teach you is two things. And this is, the first one's going to sound gross, but it's true. They say sleep on your back and sleep like this, because if you sleep like this, the rats will come and bite your fingers.
Uh-huh.
And I woke up one time with a rat on my face.
Oh, really?
A wet rat on my face. It may have been the most terrified I've ever been. And the other thing is, have your shoes and your pants set up so that if a rocket attack starts, you can jump into them instantly. And you, depending on your status of that time, you would either go to the bunker, mm-hmm. to stay out of the way of the rockets, or go to where you work to help fend off the attack.
Okay.
So that's how that started. Then I went to work. And I worked with a fairly large crew. In the operations center, there may have been, I don't know, 5 or 6 people. But I had the same job as 2 other guys who became my best friends there. And we would work from 6 in the morning until 6 at night. And then you're off 24 hours. And then, obviously, your next shift is from 6 at night till 6 in the morning. So it was, you know, it was a hard to get into a regular life. But like anything else, you're young and you can accommodate yourself into that life. Sleep, you know, at first, sleeping's hard because, you know, it's a different type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we got into it. And like I said, what we did was we would schedule primarily helicopters, but sometimes fixed-wing planes too, from all over to pick up troops and food and medical supplies and sometimes doctors and nurses and resupply anything and get them from one place to another. And sometimes if it was an assault, you're employing all kinds of different things, different types of attack helicopters and then troop helicopters. And we worked with U.S. troops, we worked with South Vietnamese, we worked with Australians, we worked with Koreans. It was interesting, and I felt a good sense of accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
I was not there. It is not my nature to want to hurt somebody, but it is my nature to want to do my job well. So I made sure that I did my job extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, I would go up and fly with my commanding officer would want to take us up and put us on the headset. Sometimes I even sat in the door gunner seat, and we would go down, look around, and, you know, what can we do? Yeah, shoot. But I never saw a person that had a shoot. But there were times, you know, we're lifting kids in terrible medical straits off the ground. And there were times that guys wouldn't get off the helicopters and they had to get pushed off. It was sad, but you had a job to do. If you're going to be there, you had to do it.
Right.
I will share with you the saddest thing that I experienced, and that was we were on an airlift carrying infantry troops, and we were all hooked up on that. There's a big airlift. Mm-hmm. We were carrying infantry troops from one of the big infantry divisions. And I was on the headset, and I could hear my commander, and I could also hear the infantry commander. And there was a big firefight on the ground between Viet Cong and our guys. And the lieutenant on the ground called up, and he said, "We've got to secure the area. What do you want me to do with the prisoners, sir?" And the general in the helicopter said, "I'm sorry, I don't understand you, son." And the lieutenant said, "Well, what do you want me to do with the prisoners?" And the general said, "I don't believe you have any prisoners, son."
As in,
correct.
Mm. How did you feel about, like, the war while you were over there?
I was possessed with doing my job well. I was a United States citizen. I for my entire life, have loved my country. I still believe there's nothing like it. I've traveled around the world. And I had a job to do, and I did it to the best of my ability. I can best answer your question, perhaps, by saying when I came back to Gettysburg, the pro and anti-war factions were in full bloom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was probably a prize to either side, since I had served. And both approached me, and I turned both sides down.
And then, I guess, like, when was the first time that you experienced rockets being launched onto the base?
Oh, I think it was the second week I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became fairly common. I'll get into some esoteric stuff on artillery here. American okay. artillery, and we would call in artillery when we would do the airlifts,
mm-hmm.
is calibrated and stepped. You know, the first one goes here, and the guy twists it, and the next one goes here, because you think that's the line you want to go. The Viet Cong and North Vietnamese Army would put their rocket launchers in the crook of a tree and then bend it a little bit. So you never knew where their rockets were going to land. So
okay.
you really, really were afraid. Even if one landed over here, the next one might land here.
Mm.
So when the rocket attacks would come, the alarms would go off. And like I said, I knew if I had to go into my work, you know, you were told you'd be on call because we always set things up. Or I'd go into the bunker,
mm-hmm.
and you go down underground in the bunker. The only distinct injury that occurred to me in Vietnam was that the alarm went off, rockets really landed, and I started running out of my hooch and ran right into a T-post that had a fire extinguisher on it and knocked my teeth out. A couple upper teeth. But they got them back, and I got them fully fixed when I got back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
But the kind of a yin and yang thing was, it was a monsoon season in Vietnam. And serious rain. Like we've never experienced here, except maybe in an incredible downpour during a hurricane or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it lasts and lasts and lasts. It's bad because everything floods.
Right.
But it's good because there's no fighting.
That's true.
We're not flying. They're not walking.
Mm-hmm.
There was always rumors of that the Northern Vietnam Army had Chinese tanks. And whenever that rumor came, we would all get really scared. But we never saw any tanks come.
Mm-hmm.
However, there were ground attacks, but we were never breached. And they would always come after rocket attacks. But, I mean, I saw guys get killed. I didn't see them get killed, but I saw them after they got killed. And I saw plenty of people in body bags. And it's just luck of the draw. I knew that.
Right.
I built up an incredible sense of appreciation. I think I've always had one. I think I got it from my family, but things like hot showers and refrigerators and dry socks and good food. And I've never forgotten that. Mm-hmm. Every day after, I'm not a preacher of any sorts, but every day after that has been a gift for me, mm-hmm. and I know that.
Right. What was it like the first time that you saw the bodies of soldiers? How did you react to that?
I'm not sure exactly. The only thing I remember is somebody said something to me and I couldn't talk. I mean, I might have thrown up, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I don't recall. I just remembered somebody asked me a question I couldn't respond.
Right. And then what was it like when you had to fly to oversee the missions? Just could you talk a bit more about those?
When I was doing that, mm-hmm. it was part of, it was, I don't want to say it was fun, but I was witnessing the tactical aspect of what I had put together.
Okay.
So I would see the assault helicopters that I had ordered come in right on time. Mm-hmm. And then there was a thing called Smokey, which was a big helicopter, CH-47, which is one of those big fat ones that the troops may have seen them in the movies or something.
Right.
And that guy comes in, and he spreads smoke on the ground so that hopefully the other troops, the enemy troops, couldn't see anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then our gunships come in and blast away, and then our troop trips come in, and it's almost like a ballet, if it's done right. It is coordinated and choreographed, and I hate to call it a beautiful thing to see, but from my viewpoint, based on my job, it was.
How often did you go on those?
I would say 3 or 4 times a month.
So, like, how far away would you go with those? Would it be close to base, or?
Yeah, every organization in the Army has an area that they oversee.
Mm-hmm.
So, there was our base, and if I remember, we used helicopter companies out of 4 other bases, and there would be different infantry and medical teams and stuff in each of those bases. And there would be helicopters there, but less. We had the most, and we also had fixed wing at our base. So everything was in this area. I would say it was no more than 20 miles.
Okay. And then what was it like just living on the base? I know we've talked a little bit about it, but just like what the soldier who you stayed with, like, did you say, like, with him most of the time, or the one who is in?
Well, he had the same job as me, so 2/3 of the time we wouldn't see each other except for the briefing.
Okay.
Yeah. One of the, this is kind of like out of a movie, but we had two really nice things on our base.
Mm-hmm.
One was there was this big white wooden wall that they could show movies on. And it would be like being on that, we'd all have folding chairs and go out and watch movies,
mm-hmm.
real movies. And for some reason, we also had an outdoor swimming pool.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So every once in a while, most of the officers used it, but it wasn't off limits. I would go use it.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that made our area attractive to some people, our Hooch area, is since we controlled the aircraft, we could get people rides places. And we would trade, you know, say one of the cooks wanted a ride to Saigon. We had a helicopter going to Saigon. And we would say, okay, we want 6 steaks or 4 pounds of ground beef for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would take the spices and we would buy some potatoes and stuff from the local Vietnamese people. And we would make a pretty good meal over, like, Bunsen burners. And people would smell it and come. So that was a nice aspect of our life there.
What was, like, the normal army food that you ate, like, most days, though?
It was bland. Mm-hmm. It was, there was always a potato, and there was always an overcooked vegetable, and there was always some type of meat. I remember most of the time it was steak because there's lots of cows in it. It was a great steak, but it was steak.
Yeah, it was something. Let's see what else.
I would occasionally go to Saigon myself, and that was interesting in that I also, when I was there, do you know what R&R means?
No.
I'll tell you about that in a minute.
Okay.
I went to Saigon, and mostly they would tell you, don't eat anything, particularly from a street vendor, you know, because it could have organisms that are going to get you. Not that they're going to poison you, just make you sick.
Right.
So mostly we'd go to outdoor cafes and just drink beer and watch stuff. But there were parts of Saigon that were like a city, not as nice as an American city, but a city. But most of it was like alleys and street vendors and carts and stuff like that. When I went on R&R, I went to Bangkok, which was a fascinating city. R&R means rest and recreation. You get, I believe, 5 days. And you had a choice of like 8 different places to go. Mm-hmm. Australia and Kuala Lumpur and I think Tokyo was on the list. And I went to Bangkok. And Bangkok is this unbelievable mix of opulent temples. I mean, with gold-plated Buddhas and things. And then abject poverty right next door. And then repeat that. Mm-hmm. But there was a great amount of beauty. I remember flowers in Bangkok being spectacular. And you could take trips down the river. It was getting to see a country and a way of life I've never seen.
Mm-hmm.
The indigenous Vietnamese who worked for us, we had ladies called Hooch Girls, which their main thing was they would do our laundry, shine our boots, do stuff like that. They were nice people, and they attempted to learn English, and they would speak a language. It was part Vietnamese, part French, because the French were there before we were,
right,
and part English. And I found most of them to be very good people. Now, the rumor had been that all Vietnamese have 2 flags and raise the flag of whoever was in charge of their area. But I never felt that any of them were traitorous to us or even would have been. Maybe I was naive, but I never felt that.
Yeah. What was it like just the change in culture and everything going to Vietnam?
I mean, it's night and day.
Right.
I didn't have to worry about what I was going to wear. I had no car. I had no girlfriend. I had no good food. Some days there was no showers. Like I said, I got by trying to be, and most of the time achieving, the best I could at my job. I was totally focused on my job.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was off and not sleeping, enjoying the friends that I had. But, it's culture shock.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't get to go to the Saigon prom, you know.
Yeah. So, do you have any other interesting stories that you want to share?
Yes. Another decision came up that may reinforce me being the stupidest person ever. But that one worked out good too. In the Army, when you're drafted, you serve for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are ending your time of service at that time in Vietnam with 5 months or less left. They let you out at 19 months because it just wouldn't be worth retraining you, relocating you, blah, blah, blah. So my end of time in Vietnam was 5 months and 5 days. So I could make the choice to stay an extra 5 days. And it was agonizing because there were apocryphal tales of guys that stayed one day and died.
Right.
And we were under heavy shelling at that time. But the world had changed so much in America, and I wanted to see it. The music had changed. The styles had changed. Attitudes had changed. Things looked really exciting and fun, and I wanted to experience it. I didn't want to go back to some army base. I wanted to go back to the summer in the States and go stay at the beach for the summer and then go back to Gettysburg. And I chose to stay the 5 days. And the last couple days, my commanding officer, who was a great guy, said, if you want to spend the last couple days, your replacement's here, just stay in the bunker if you want. And I did, and it worked out. Do you want to talk about coming here? Coming back here?
Yeah. So what was it like transitioning back to Gettysburg and just to life in general?
Well, like I said, so much had changed. Whereas when I left, most people still have relatively short hair. Men. And nobody was taking drugs. And protests, while they existed around the country, they hadn't really arrived at Gettysburg yet. There might have been a couple that I would call, but it wasn't predominant. But when I came back, it was totally different. I'll digress and tell you a quick story. When I wrote from Vietnam to the Dean of Admissions, saying I wanted to go back in the fall of 1969, and I got a letter back saying, you're in. Understand that any returning student is automatically on probation, and here are the terms of that probation. One of which was you can't have a car. And I wrote back and I said, there's people here trying to kill me every day and you tell me I can't have a car. And they waived it, which was great.
Yeah.
So I got back and attitudes were different. People were mad. There was, you know, draft card burning and riots and real hatred in America. And I didn't want to be part of it. I would talk to anybody, and I would tell basic stories, but I wouldn't take a side. And if somebody wanted to really get dramatic on pro-war or anti-war, I would walk out of the room. I didn't want it. I wanted to compartmentalize that part of my life. Like I keep coming back to, I was proud of what I did.
Mm-hmm.
I was not proud of being in a war, but I was proud of the job I did for my country.
Right.
And I also did not, and you've seen these people, I shouldn't say these people, that's a bad thing to say, but you've seen people like on Rolling Thunder and things where there are still guys my age and younger who Vietnam is their identity.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And I did not want Vietnam to be my identity. Mm-hmm. I wanted to come back and start my regular life over again. And other things had changed here. When I left, the campus was dry. When I came back, the campus was, the second semester I was here, the campus was wet. It had gone from, you know, booze on campus to booze on campus. There's none now, is there? Or is there?
It depends.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was legal. And we had also gone from Gettysburg when I was first here was 5 courses, 2 semesters.
Mm-hmm.
And we had switched 2-4-1-4. January was a single term.
Okay.
You don't have that now.
No, we don't.
I know some colleges do have it now.
Mm-hmm.
And that was good too. This is a digress story, but it's a fun story. Here's a professor who really struck me. The January term, I took a course called Novels into Film, which is exactly what it sounds like. Mm-hmm. We read books and watch the movie. And was taught by a young professor, long hair, first kind of hippie professor I had ever seen, named Bob Fredrickson. Very cool guy, made a big impression on me. And often he would invite us to his house for the class. We would sit around on the floor. And the only requirement for your grade was that we choose one of the novels in the film. And I think we did three. And write a paper on it. Mm-hmm. It's coming up end of that single semester. And Bob Fredrickson says, he was an incredible Bob Dylan. And he said, Bob Dylan is doing an East Coast tour. He's going to be in Baltimore and Philadelphia and D.C. And I want to see all the concerts. So I won't have time to look at your papers until after this semester is long gone. He said, I will eventually get to them and give you feedback. He said, but I'm going to see Bob Dylan. He goes, what I'd like to make you an offer is that I will give you all a B. This has been a fun class. This has been an easy class. I don't think B in a January semester hurts anybody. So will you take it? And all of us took it except one guy who said, my work is superb. I want you to grade it. Mm-hmm. You know how this ends up, right?
How?
We went and saw the grades posted. He was the only C.
Of course.
Yeah, but it was different. I mean, there was people in tie-dye and people wearing bandanas and, like I said, flag burning. And to a lot of people, class and became secondary to cause. And there's a thing called Symposium 70 that you could look up that invited anti-war people, big deal anti-war people from around the country here. Mm-hmm. And some students got in big trouble for that.
Mm. How often were there burnings of the giraffe slips or anything like that on campus?
I don't recall. Mm-hmm. You know, the big universities, you know, Columbia was one of the main places for that, University of Chicago.
Right.
I think the stuff I remember on Gettysburg is there would be bonfires like in a parking lot, mm-hmm. and people around it and singing songs and chanting slogans and holding up signs, things like that.
Okay. And then
you could ask Professor Berkner, he was here in 1970.
And then also with the end, or actually, so you spent 9 semesters at Gettysburg then, right?
Correct.
Okay. So when you graduated in May 1970, there was the whole Kent State shooting, and like, how did that affect your views on the war, and then like also just what happened here on campus with that?
The Kent State thing made me so, so sad. The people who did that shooting weren't Army, they were National Guard. Mm-hmm. Not fully trained. From what I can tell from that incident, the officers who should have been in charge of them weren't. I mean, this is what I've heard, you know, I wasn't there.
Right.
It shouldn't have happened, and it made me terribly sad. I think there's culpability on both sides. The soldiers, the National Guard troops, shouldn't have been doing it. From what I understand, they warned the kids. If I was warned somebody was going to shoot, I wouldn't have kept coming. I think they didn't believe me. And you get the National Guard guy, he's going to be like, you know, some kid like me. You know, 18, 19, 20 years old, he doesn't know. He got his finger on the trigger. I don't even know if he wants to pull it or not, but he did.
Right.
He's got the safety off, he's got his finger there, and he pulled it. Mm-hmm. He might have felt threatened. So, again, I'm not on a side, but my reaction was terrible sorrow.
Mm-hmm. What was the rest of the campus like with that?
I think it was similar. There was a moment in time, and I think it for people who are on the fringe of being radicalized, it radicalized them. And I think there were people who said, got it coming, and it maybe radicalized them in the other direction. But I think the bulk of people felt this was just an example of the terrible things that are going on in our country right now.
And what were your reactions when the war was finally over?
I was way past it at that time. The war really, you know, it wasn't like World War I or World War II, where there was like an armistice and the world and the war stopped.
Right.
This was kind of a dribble, dribble, dribble. And then, you know, you saw the pictures of the last people getting on the helicopters to get out. And I saw those on the news, but it wasn't, yes, I didn't feel relieved, because it had been coming over a protracted period of time. I had moved on. I will tell you that, and this isn't, I don't think it's a cognitive decision on my part, but I told you earlier, I have friends from kindergarten that I see. I have friends from grade school, high school, college, I see. I have friends from all my jobs that I see. Mm-hmm. I don't see anybody from Vietnam.
Yeah. And then just how did your impressions of the college change once you graduated? Just because you had that gap where you were in Vietnam.
I still love this place. I loved it then. I love it now. I come back every year. I play in the golf tournament. On every reunion weekend, they have a golf tournament. And
okay.
A bunch of people come back and play. Mm-hmm. Some years I stick around for the reunion stuff. A lot of years I just play golf with my buddies and see some other people, have dinner, and go back the next day. But I'm here every year. Mm-hmm. This is different for me because there's students here. And
right. When
we come back for that, there's no students. And I wish it was a nicer day. I like seeing the college of students. Now, you're going to think this is strange looking at me and knowing how old I am, but I have a stepson who's a freshman at the University of Delaware. I even have a stepson who's a high school student. So I like seeing students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you like continue with your fraternity and doing tennis and all of that when you got back to Gettysburg?
I continued in intramural sports, yeah. It was, I don't know how it is now, it was an important thing for your fraternity to win intramural sports.
Okay. Yeah.
And the fraternities still had not a whole lot of time passed, so fraternities have identities, sororities have identities, and the identities haven't changed. They're still very similar. Mm. The one really nice thing for me is having started in 1963 and leaving in 1970, I know 10 years of students. You follow
yeah,
that?
That's true. Yeah.
So it was nice to know people from all those eras, and I still am in touch with some people from the beginning. I'll see some of them tonight.
Great. And then, I guess, how was that, like, transitioning back? Because you had such a gap between when you first were here and after the war. Just, like, transitioning with, like, friends and everything.
Well, I certainly matured, both by year and by war.
Right.
So, but I'll go back to what I said before. The biggest thing I came with is just this greatly enhanced sense of appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
Happy to have my friends, happy to see my friends. Everybody I saw was a big embrace.
Mm-hmm. And then after you graduated, did you go on to graduate school or?
No, this is kind of unique too. After I graduated, I traveled around the country for a little bit, visiting friends.
Okay.
And went to Pennsylvania, Texas, California, came back east, and I basically worked for two companies for the rest of my life. And now I'm retired. My wife and I do a variety of business things from our house. So mm-hmm. It's been great.
Okay. So I think that's a good place to end it off.
Sure.